You know, when we talk about mission-critical power systems on the show, I think we usually picture something massive.
Huge data centers, yeah.
Yeah,
Or backup generators.
exactly. Or, the power grid for a nuclear submarine.
Yeah.
We think of heavy metal, massive capacity. But today, I want you to picture something much more fragile.
Extremely fragile and completely, totally isolated.
Right. So imagine you're building a stratosonde. It's a high-altitude balloon payload. You're launching this thing up, what, 20, maybe 30 kilometers into the stratosphere?
Or it's 60 degrees below zero. It's basically a vacuum.
And the second you let go of that tether, that's it. There is absolutely no way to plug it into a wall outlet.
I mean, that's just the classic engineering nightmare, isn't it? You're completely severed from the grid. You're 100% dependent on whatever you can harvest from the environment.
And if you fail at that,
The payload dies. Simple as that.
That's the real hook for today's deep dive. We're looking at a set of engineering logs from the Stratasonde development blog, specifically a post from November 22, 2025.
And this isn't some, theoretical paper on how solar panels should work.
No, this is a detective story. It's about why the math didn't match what was actually happening.
Right. It's all about the gap between that data sheet fantasy, what the manufacturer promises you, and the brutal physics of a freezing cold day in Calgary.
The stakes here are just incredibly high. If the batteries die, the heater dies.
And if the heater dies, the electronics freeze solid. Mission over.
So you have this payload spinning uncontrollably in the jet stream. You have these tiny little solar panels and a desperate need to squeeze every single milliwatt out of a really low winter sun.
It seems so simple on paper,
Right.
right? You buy a 100 milliwatt panel, you stick it on the box.
You expect 100 milliwatts.
But as we're about to find out, getting even 10% of that is a war against, well, against
Did I
geometry.
always start with that naive assumption? Because I think we've all been there. I buy a solar panel for camping or something, and the box says 5 volts, 100 milliamps, and I do the quick math in my head. Power is voltage times current. So I assume I have half a watt of power. Why is that? Well, why is that a lie?
It's not a lie exactly, but it's a best case scenario that basically never happens in the real world. The data sheet gives you two key numbers: open circuit voltage,
Which is VOC.
exactly, folk, and then short circuit current, or ESC.
Okay, so let's unpack that. VOC is the voltage when the wires aren't connected to anything, right? It's just pure potential.
That's it. It's like the pressure just sitting in the cell. And short circuit current is the complete opposite extreme. That's when you touch the wires together and let all the electrons just flood out.
But in both of those cases, you're doing zero useful work.
Correct. Think of it like a water hose. If you plug the end with your thumb, you've got high pressure, that's your voltage, but you have no flow, that's zero power.
Right.
And if you just let the water spill out with no nozzle, you've got high flow but no pressure, also zero useful power. The real power is somewhere in the middle.
It's a curve,
Yeah.
and the whole game is finding the absolute peak of that curve.
That's the maximum power point, or MPP. It's that sweet spot. If your electronics miss that sweet spot,
The energy is just gone.
it evaporates. It literally just dissipates as a tiny bit of heat in the silicon. It never makes it to your battery. You are leaving free energy on the table.
So for the Stratasonde, the engineer is using these specific little cells, Ioshi polycrystalline silicon. They're tiny, 52 by 19 millimeters.
Yeah, and the goal is to feed a really common harvesting chip, the BQ25570.
Which is designed for this kind of low-power scavenging.
Exactly. It sips energy from almost nothing.
But instead of just trusting a simulation, the developer did something I really respect. They went outside.
On November 22nd, in Calgary, Alberta, latitude 51 degrees north.
And that context is so important.
It's vital. November in Calgary is what we call a marginal power zone. The sun is low, it's barely scraping the horizon. The light is coming in at this slanted angle through all this atmosphere.
So if you can make a solar system work here.
You can probably make it work almost anywhere.
So they set up this experiment to trace exactly where the power was going. They ran four scenarios, and the drop-off between them is honestly terrifying.
Let's walk through them. Scenario one is the ideal case.
Right, tracking the sun.
So this is 10:00 a.m. and noon, and they are physically holding the panel, so it's perfectly perpendicular to the sun's rays. This is, God mode for solar.
You're giving it every possible advantage.
And at noon, doing that, they got about 48 milliwatts.
Okay, so that's our benchmark. That is the absolute physical limit of what that panel can do on that day in that spot.
48 milliwatts. Remember that number.
Okay, scenario two. Now we get to the reality of the balloon. The Stratosonde flies with the panel mounted horizontally. It's like a flat hat on top of the payload.
So they just laid the panel flat on the table at 12:30 p.m.
And the power plummets to 18 milliwatts.
That is a massive, massive hit.
You've lost more than 60% of your power just from the angle.
It's painful, but it's kind of expected from the geometry. But the real shock, the one that really matters, was scenario 3.
Yeah, this is the one that caught me total off guard. They simulated a little wobble. They tilted the panel just 20 degrees away from the sun.
Which is nothing. 20 degrees is a slight list. You'd think, okay, maybe the power drops another 10%.
Maybe down to, what, 15 or 16 milliwatts?
It went from 18 milliwatts down to 2.3.
2.3. That is effectively zero. That's a dead probe.
A dead probe.
So why? What is physically happening there? The sun didn't turn off? The angle wasn't that bad?
This is the big gotcha of real-world hardware.
Mm-hmm.
It's a thing called self-shadowing.
Self-shadowing.
We think of a solar panel as this perfect, flat, 2D surface.
Mm.
But it's not. It's a 3D object. It has a thickness. It has a little resin frame around the edge.
Ah, okay, I see where this is going.
When that sun is skimming the horizon in a Calgary winter, the light is coming in almost horizontally. And that tiny little rim, maybe only a millimeter high,
casts a long shadow.
A really long shadow, right across the surface of the cell, like a fence post at sunset.
And solar cells are super sensitive to partial shading.
Incredibly sensitive. It's not linear. If you shade 10% of the cell, you don't lose 10% of the power. You might lose 90% of it.
Why is it so extreme?
Because the cells are basically diodes wired up in series. If you shade one part, that shaded section stops conducting electricity, and it actually becomes a resistor.
It blocks the flow from the parts that are still in the sun.
You've created a bottleneck.
Yeah.
The internal resistance spikes, and the entire system just collapses.
So that 2.3 milliwatt number is a huge wake-up call. It proves that, you know, the theoretical geometry isn't enough. You have to account for the physical shadow from the glue and the frame.
And it changes your whole design philosophy.
Yeah.
You realize that trying to tilt the panel to catch more sun might actually be the thing that kills you.
Which brings us to the big debate in the logs. You've got this huge gap, 48 milliwatts if you aim at the sun versus 18 if you lay it flat. I'm looking at that as a mission planner and I'm screaming, build a tracker.
Of course. Why throw away 30 milliwatts?
Yeah, why not put the panel on a little servo and just aim it?
It's the temptation of optimization. It's so seductive. But you have to remember the constraints of the platform.
Mm.
And constraint number one is the azimuth problem.
The spin.
The spin. The Stratosonde is hanging from a string under a balloon. It's spinning, sometimes fast, sometimes slow. And we have no way to stop it.
So if you mount a panel vertically on the side to try and catch that low sun.
Then half the time, it's facing away from the sun. It's facing north. Into deep space.
You get the sine wave of power. Full power, then zero, then full, then zero.
Which batteries hate. Voltage regulators hate that. And your average power gets cut in half right away.
Whereas the horizontal mount, the hat on top, it doesn't care about spin.
It's omnidirectional. It presents the exact same face to the sky no matter which way the payload is pointing. It's consistent.
And for something like this, consistency beats peak performance.
Almost always.
But we still have to deal with that massive power loss. You mentioned cosine loss earlier. That's the math behind why the flat panel did so poorly, right?
Yes, this is pure geometry. Imagine you're holding a bucket out in the rain. If the rain is coming straight down and you hold the bucket upright, you catch the most water.
Right. Your aperture is wide open.
Exactly. Now, what if the rain is coming in sideways, driven by wind? If you keep holding the bucket upright, almost nothing gets in. The effective area of the bucket, from the rain's point of view, is now a thin little slit.
And in Calgary, the sun is the sideways rain.
That's it, exactly.
Yep.
The sun is only 17 degrees above the horizon, so the light is hitting that flat panel at a glancing angle of 73 degrees.
And the math says the power you get is proportional to the cosine of that angle.
Which, for 73 degrees, is about 0.29.
So you're only getting 29% of the available light.
And that perfectly explains the drop from 48 milliwatts down to around 18. It's not a flaw in the panel, it's just the geometry of living at 51 degrees north.
But the engineer did consider a workaround, what they called the tilt trap.
Right, the idea of, okay, if I can't track it, maybe I could just permanently tilt it on a little ramp.
But to catch that low sun in Calgary, you'd have to tilt it up, what, 73 degrees?
So it's almost vertical. It's basically standing up.
And the moment you do that,
you're right back to the azimuth problem.
Yeah.
If the balloon spins, the back of that ramp is now blocking the sun.
So you're completely trapped. If you tilt it to catch the sun, the spin kills you. If you lay it flat, the cosine geometry kills you.
It's a pick your poison kind of scenario.
Yeah.
And the engineer made the pragmatic choice, horizontal mounting. They just accepted the loss.
Why?
Because 18 milliwatts of continuous, predictable, reliable power is so much better than a system that might give you 48 milliwatts. If the motor doesn't freeze, and if the gears work, and if the sensors don't fail.
Right.
Complex mechanical systems are the first things to die at minus 60. A flat panel glued to a box has no moving parts. It can't fail unless the sun explodes.
Reliability over perfection. I get it. No, we've been focused on Calgary, which is clearly hard mode for solar, but this balloon isn't just going to sit there.
No, it's going to drift.
And the source material has this fascinating global heat map.
Right, because you don't design a ship just for the harbor. You design for the open ocean. They modeled this horizontal setup all across the globe.
So if the jet stream carries this thing south, maybe towards the equator?
Then the horizontal mount suddenly looks like a genius move. At the equator, the sun is high overhead all day. That cosine loss basically disappears.
And you're getting how much?
About 60 milliwatts of steady, reliable power year-round.
What about the mid-latitudes, say over the U.S. or Europe?
It's seasonal. Mm-hmm. In the summer, you're great, 50 to 60 milliwatts. In the winter, you take a hit, but it's survivable.
But Calgary is right on that edge.
51 degrees north is the tipping point.
Yeah.
In June, you're fine. In December, you're down to 17 milliwatts. And if you go any further north, into the Arctic Circle.
The horizontal mount fails completely.
In the winter, yeah. The sun either doesn't rise at all, or it skims so low that the atmosphere and self-shadowing just kill you.
So by testing in Calgary in November, they were basically validating the worst reasonable case.
Exactly. The logic is, if the power budget works with 15 milliwatts, the mission is a go. If it drifts south, that extra power is just a bonus. You never design for the bonus, you design for the minimum.
Okay, so we've settled the physical design, flat mount on top, we accept the losses, now we have to actually harvest those electrons.
The electronic surgery part of the logs, this is where it gets really nitty gritty.
Right, because this is about tuning that BQ25570 chip. It uses a method called fractional open circuit voltage to find that MPP, that sweet spot. How does a dumb chip know where that is?
It uses a really clever shortcut. I mean, a sophisticated solar controller has a little computer that's constantly testing the voltage, hunting for the peak. But that takes power to run.
Power we don't have. We're counting single milliwatts.
Right. So the BQ25570 assumes that the maximum power point is always at a fixed percentage of the open circuit voltage. So every 16 seconds, it disconnects the panel for a split second, samples that open voltage, and then calculates a target.
It says, okay, open voltage is half a volt, so I'm going to pull power until the panel voltage drops down to, say, 80% of that.
Exactly. And that percentage is physically set by the engineer using a couple of resistors on the board.
But the standard default for these chips is usually 80%,
right? It's the industry rule of thumb for this kind of silicon. 80%. If you buy a dev board, it's set to 80%.
But the engineer didn't trust the rule of thumb. They looked at their own data from Calgary.
And this is where doing that physical testing really paid off. They measured the open voltage of their specific cells at 0.56 volts. But the actual peak power, the top of that hill, was at 0.42 volts.
Okay, let me do the math. 0.42 divided by 0.56. That's exactly 75%.
75%, not 80.
Is that 5% difference really that big a deal? It feels like we're splitting hairs.
On this part of the power curve, yes. It's absolutely critical.
So walk me through what happens if we just leave it at the default 80%.
Okay, so 80% of 0.56 volts is about 0.448 volts. The chip would try to hold the panel at roughly 0.45 volts. But the real peak, remember, is back at 0.42.
So we're to the right of the peak. We've overshot it.
And you're on the cliff side of the curve. These IV curves aren't symmetrical. They go up gradually, hit a peak, and then drop off incredibly sharply. If you overshoot that peak voltage even a tiny bit, the current just plummets.
So by aiming for 0.45 volts instead of 0.42, you might actually be losing 20 or 30% of your total power.
Easily. You just slide right off the power dome. By manually changing those resistors to target exactly 75%, the engineer makes sure the chip clamps down right on the peak.
It's like tuning an old radio. If you're slightly off the frequency, you don't just get a slightly quieter song, you get pure static.
That's a perfect analogy.
Yeah.
In the blazing sun at the equator, you have so much power, it might not matter if you're a bit inefficient. But in that marginal zone, sunrise, sunset, or Calgary winter, that tuning is the difference between charging the battery and the whole system shutting down.
It's amazing that so much of the mission's success comes down to a single resistor value.
That's engineering, right? It's not always big, shiny rockets. Sometimes it's a 10-kilo resistor and a soldering iron, and really understanding your specific components.
So let's tally the final budget. We have the horizontal mount. We have the tuned chip. What can the Stratosonde actually count on day to day?
The conservative estimate from the logs is about 15 to 18 milliwatts of sustained power during the daylight hours.
That is incredibly small. That's barely enough to light a single LED.
It is tight. And at night, of course, it's zero. But there is one final silver lining in the source material. A little bonus from the environment.
We could certainly use one after all those losses.
The stratosphere is very cold, and the air is very thin.
And how does that help?
Well, the thin air means more solar intensity, less filtering, but the temperature is the big one. Silicon solar cells actually work better when they're cold.
Really? I always assume electronics hate the cold. My phone dies instantly in the winter.
Batteries definitely hate the cold. Chemical reactions slow down. But solar cells love it. As the temperature drops, the internal resistance of the semiconductor goes down and the voltage actually goes up.
So that data sheet we started with, that was probably tested at room temperature, 25 Celsius.
Correct. But at minus 60 Celsius in the stratosphere, the engineer estimates you get a 10 to 15% boost in efficiency compared to the ground tests.
So nature gives us a little rebate at the end.
A little thank you for surviving the harsh conditions. The next step in the blog is to validate all this in a cold chamber test to prove the math holds up before launch.
It's a fascinating journey. We started with a data sheet promising 100 milliwatts. We lost half of it to basic geometry. We lost another huge chunk to the angle of the sun. We almost lost the rest to self-shadowing and bad tuning, but we clawed it back.
Scraped together just enough to survive. And really, that's what makes this so useful for anyone doing a project, even if it's not a high-altitude balloon.
I think the biggest takeaway for me is that idea of optimization versus robustness. The engineer could have chased the absolute highest power number.
You could have built a tracker. They could have tilted the panel.
But they chose the lower number, that 18 milliwatts, because it was predictable. They chose the solution with fewer ways to fail.
It really makes you think about our own projects, doesn't it? How often do we plan for the perfect day, the day we have full energy, full focus, no interruptions?
And how often do we actually design our workflows for the Calgary winter?
That's the key lesson. It's easy to design for the best case. It is incredibly hard to have the discipline to design for the worst case. But that's what keeps you in the air.
There's one final question I've been mulling over, though. The engineer optimized everything for this hard mode, that marginal zone at 51 degrees north. But you mentioned the balloon might drift to the tropics.
Yeah, where there's abundant power.
So does over-optimizing for the worst-case scenario handicap you when things are going well? If we tuned the resistors for a weak light, do we lose out when the light is strong?
That is the ultimate trade-off in any kind of design. If you build a ship to survive a hurricane, it's going to be heavy and slow in calm waters.
And if you build a race boat for calm waters, you sink in the first storm.
Exactly. And in the stratosphere, survival comes first. You can't use bonus power if your system is already dead.
So if you tune for the worst case and hit a good day,
you just have extra power you might not even need. If you tune for the best case and hit a bad day, the mission is over.
A profound thought to leave us on. Survival first. Thanks for guiding us through all that.
My pleasure.
And to you listening, next time you see a solar panel on a calculator or on a roof, just remember, the number on the box is only the beginning of the story. There's a whole world of geometry, physics, and shadows hiding in there. We'll see you on the next Steep Dive.